Hi, everybody. It's good to see you again and be with you all again. And always look forward to being here. Come here many, many years off and on, and glad to know new people that I meet when I'm here. I would like you to open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 25. And shortly, we're going to begin reading in verse 27. And we'll go down to the end of the chapter. Now, this is not an unfamiliar story, but it's a very relevant story. Again, as I've mentioned to you before, the Old Testament has lots of value. Paul even said it did in 1 Corinthians 10 and Romans 15. It's written for our learning, our admonition. We can draw some very, very present-day applications from it, and that's what I hope to do not only in this class, but in our morning lesson when we get into that a little bit later this morning. Most of you know, before I read this, the story of Esau and Jacob, and we know that their birth is recorded here. Esau is the firstborn. He came out before Jacob did, so he is the firstborn in the sight of Isaac and God, as far as that's concerned. But we also find out, as we're going to read, that Esau is a man who can be manipulated. And his brother will extremely manipulate him here in what we're going to focus on this morning. Now, granted, when you go on a couple of chapters over, Esau kind of manipulated there because his mother Rebekah and his brother Jacob will conspire against him to get the blessing that he also rightfully deserved from Isaac. That is no question. That's in Genesis 27, 5 through 17, where I encourage you to read, where there's no question that Rebekah and Jacob conspired to get that blessing away from Esau, and they will succeed. So I guess what I'm trying to say is Esau is a man that has reasons to be hateful toward his brother, because I think he's going to realize he got manipulated in the story we're going to focus on here. And he's going to obviously know that his mother and his brother conspired to take the blessing that he deserved to get. And that is a hard thing to deal with emotionally, because the Bible was very clear that Esau is very hateful toward his brother, and with the manipulation here and then the deception, that's the word I'm looking for later, it is going to cost him everything. But I'm not going to give Esau a pass. And the one time, brethren, he's mentioned in the New Testament, it is not in a complimentary way. We'll eventually get over to Hebrews 12:16, and even there he is not portrayed in a positive light. And even though he's manipulated, he, in my world, he does not get a pass. So with that said, let's read Genesis 25, verses 27 through the end of the chapter. Now, this is right after the two boys are born. Remember, Esau came out first and then Jacob. And there's a whole lesson that I can't even go toward here in this same text. I'm going to focus on it briefly, but it probably explains some of the problems that these brothers are going to have. I'm reading from the American Standard Version, so you may have a newer translation, and it may vary a little bit. The boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. Oh, we'd call him an outdoorsman, wouldn't we, today? Jacob was a contrast. He was a quiet man who dwelled in tents. So these brothers are different, and there's nothing wrong with that. Now, here's the problem. Here is a big problem which is worthy of a sermon on its own or a lesson on its own. Because when you have parental favoritism toward your sons, and they see it, and they're aware of it, that's asking for trouble. Notice what the Bible says. Isaac loved Esau. And when you get into the Hebrew, it was a favoritism kind of love. It was obvious. He made it very clear that he preferred Esau over Jacob. And Rebekah, we know where this is going, don't we? Rebekah, because he ate of his venison, Rebekah loved Jacob. And Esau knew that. And Jacob knew that. The parental favoritism is alarming. The Hebrew brings out just how clear that is. Do you see what I mean, brethren? There's a lesson right there of its own, isn't it? And I got to rein myself in not to go and talk about that this morning, because that is so dangerous in a family. It can create a lot of problems. I think it adds to the problem here. So let's continue reading. And here's where the manipulation occurred. Jacob knew his brother, and he knew the buttons to push. I'm convinced of that. So in verse 30, Esau had come in from the field, and the American Standard said he was faint. He's weak. He's hungry. Been outdoors all day. You can relate with that if you're a hunter. You really got an appetite when you come in from a day of that. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore, his name will be called Edom. And Jacob, here comes the manipulation. Now, I'm not giving Esau a pass here, but Jacob's manipulating, isn't he? Oh, you can see it here. Jacob said, "Sell me first thy birthright." Now, I'm going to talk about how big that is in the Jewish family. To have the birthright was huge. And Jacob wants it, so he said, I got a bargain, a deal for you. I will cook you all the red pottage you can eat. I will fill you up, but it's not free. I want your birthright. And Esau understood how important that was to have the birthright. And I'm going to go to the Old Testament to show you just how big that is. And he was aware of that. He was fully aware of that. But what did he say in verse 32? "I'm about to die." Now, come on, Esau. Aren't you dramatizing that just a little bit? Maybe he thought he was about to die. I don't think he was about ready to die. But that's overwhelming him right now. "I'm about to die, and what profit shall the birthright do to me?" Now, he understood the importance of it. Jacob said, "Swear to me first." And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. And Jacob came through with his part of the bargain. He gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way, and Esau despised his birthright. He just gonna throw that away. For filling his stomach now in the present, he's giving up something hugely important down the line. Now, brethren, if you don't understand the advantage the older son had in the birthright, I don't want you to lose Genesis 25, but that is brought out very clearly in the law of Moses, just how important that was to the firstborn. Don't lose Genesis 25, but turn to Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 17. Deuteronomy, I'll give you a minute to get there. Deuteronomy 21, verse 17 will show you what a physical advantage it was for the eldest son in a household in the Jewish way of living, or during the patriarchal period, I should say. He shall acknowledge the firstborn, that would be Esau here, the son of the hated, by giving him a double portion of all that he has. double portion. For he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. So the huge advantage that Esau would have had. And double portion. A double portion of the father's inheritance. And we know that Isaac had amassed quite a gift to pass on, you know, to the son. And Esau was in line for that double portion. And not only did that give him a physical advantage, obviously, the double portion, did you know it also gave Esau rule and authority over the members of the family? Wow, that's a lot. A double portion of the father's inheritance, and he is the ruling figure and authority over all other members of the family. If you'll go back to Genesis and look in chapter 27, verse 29, wow, this is giving a lot up for a mess of pottage, isn't it? I'd call that a bad bargain. But look in Genesis 27, verse 29. Let people serve thee. Nations will bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren. And let thy mother's son bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curses thee. And blessed be everyone that blesses thee. An obvious physical advantage, isn't it? And Esau is right there for it. And I know hindsight's 20/20, and we look at this and we can't believe that he would knowingly give all of that up to feed his stomach at the moment. By the way, brethren, not only did he have a physical advantage with the double portion and the ruling of the family. Now, you know, Jacob knew all that too, didn't he? That's why he wants it so bad, doesn't he? There were spiritual advantages too. I did a little bit of reading about the role of the patriarch. And I found this in as I was studying. Not only would Esau have all those physical advantages, did you know he'd be the patriarch and priest of the house after the death of the father? Spiritually, he would be patriarch and priest of the house. Once his father passed away, he would be chief of the chosen family and heir of the promised blessing. So Esau was in line. Abraham, Isaac, and it could have been Esau, not Jacob. Do y'all remember? I know you in the Old Testament world, and a lot of you have that knowledge. Remember the initial promise. Don't lose Genesis 25, 26, 27. But do you remember the promise God made to Abraham way back in the beginning in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3? And I'll refresh your memory. Jehovah said unto Abram, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house unto the land I will show you. And I will make of thee, that's Abraham, a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and you'll be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curses thee will I curse, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And that was going to follow right down Abraham's line. So that same blessing is passed on to Isaac. And Esau is in a position to get the same blessing. And I find it amazing. Go ahead, Keith.
Yeah. You know, it's a dysfunctional family in that sense. The husband and wife aren't working together.
That,
That's right.
And they're playing favorites with the kids.
Yes.
And all that stuff just becomes such a tangled web.
Yes.
And unfortunately, all the bad things happen through, you know, people are working together.
You're exactly right, and that's all here. That's all here. And, you know, you can feel a little bit sorry for Esau. He got manipulated that way and later deceived, right? I mean, I don't have time to get into that sad story in Genesis 27, though. And that's Rebekah and Jacob conspiring, clearly conspiring. And that's all bad. But Esau understood what he was throwing away. The double portion. The physical advantages he's tossing away, the spiritual advantages he's tossing away because he was hungry and faint. And what did he say? Well, it's not going to do me any good anyway if I'm going to die, is it? Come on, Esau. I am sad that he got him allowed himself to be manipulated that way. Do you think Jacob knew that he had a weakness in that area? Yes.
Some commentators say that the reason why he was making that mental stew is because that's when Abraham passed away.
Yeah.
And so he really shouldn't stick around the house right now. There's a death in the family.
Yeah.
There's no time to go off hunting. He's here.
That's right.
A lot of commentators, when you see that the way it was arranged, is that that's a solemn occasion. The passing of Abraham should have been sacred. And he should have, you know, as a son, he would have had more respect for his grandfather.
Yeah.
So once again, it shows the condition of his heart.
Absolutely. It is, and some hard lessons to gain from it. And if I can make a quick present day application, Jacob was aware of this weakness in Esau. There's no doubt about it. And he played on it too, didn't he? Isn't that how Satan works today on us? Does he not know who we are and what our weaknesses are? I know you've heard preachers say it before, and I'm going to say it again. Satan will never attack you where he knows you're strong. He's too smart for that. He will attack you where he knows you're weak. Vulnerable. And he wants you to throw away your blessing too, doesn't he? Your double portion, if I can use that phrase. He wants you to throw it away too, to fulfill yourself right now. You're thinking of today, what I want right now. And Satan wants you thinking that way. And he wants you to throw away something that you're going to regret that you do later. Do you think Esau had a lot of regret down the line? Absolutely he did. But can you go back after he's done that? No. He bargained away. We would call it a bad bargain. His double portion. And then he lost the blessing later too, didn't he, that he rightfully deserved? And we know that was wrong too. Shame on Rebekah and Jacob for doing that. So he went to his daddy after it was done. I would like to have my blessing. And of course, Isaac's had led to him. Well, I'm sorry, I already gave it away. Are we understanding a little bit of the hatred that Esau is going to have toward his brother? And Jacob was well aware of what he was doing, wasn't he? He was well aware of what he's doing. And we know why he fled too, don't we? Because at that moment, Esau would have killed him. Now, don't lose Genesis 25. But let's look at the one reference to Esau in the New Testament. And it's not complimentary, but it brings this up. Look in Hebrews chapter 12. Verse 16. So we can, on one hand, feel a little sorry for Esau. Part of me wants to do that, though he should have never let himself be manipulated that way. But it was just downright wrong for Rebekah and Jacob to deceive and him to lose the blessing. That's just downright wrong. But Esau is not mentioned in a positive way. Look what the Bible says in Hebrews 12, 16. Lest there be any fornicator or he's described in the New Testament
as a profane person, as Esau, who for one mess of meat sold his own birthright. One mess of meat. And then reading on, for we know that even when he afterward desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for a change of mind in his father, that would be Isaac, though he sought it diligently with tears, didn't he? I mean, Esau is shedding big old tears because he already literally gave away his birthright, and now he got robbed of his blessing. He is totally out, isn't he? But such were the issues at stake here. Hugely at stake. The physical advantages of being the patriarch of the family, the double portion, and the spiritual advantage that he should have gotten. It should have been Abraham, Isaac, Esau. Genesis 12:1-3, it should have been. But we know it's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, don't we? So he chose a very foolish bargain. And brethren, in essence, he chose the sensual over the spiritual, didn't he? Now, when I was playing baseball in high school, we'd call this point a hanging curve. But that's, you wanted a hanging curve from the pitcher because that's the one you could knock out of the park. And when you think about this comment that he chose the sensual over the spiritual, you know where that can go. And the application that we're challenged with today, because oftentimes we're forced to make a choice just like that, aren't we? Choose the sensual, the gratification I'm going to get now, and throw aside the blessing that I would get otherwise. In return, he valued red pottage more than his birthright. That was, at the moment, much more valuable to him. That red pottage than his birthright. He chose the present over the future. And as one commentator said, he tossed away future rewards for present gratification. Wow. Well, that never will be me. Oh, be careful. The last time I checked, Satan is alive and well, isn't he? And there's nothing idle about Satan. There's nothing about him that he's always active, moving. Remember Peter's statement, be sober, be vigilant. Satan runs around as a roaring lion. What does it say? Seeking. He seeks us, doesn't he? He seeks us. He actively seeks us. Now, I'm glad that God does too. But Satan is actively seeking us, and he's penetrating my present gratification, and hopefully I'll throw away my future reward. Seeking who he may walk, brethren, devour. So Satan is loving what Esau did. He's clapping all away. He gave it all up for the present and threw away his future. And I'm saying, how many people today will let Satan do that to them? Now, one blessing we do have is if we do experience that instant gratification and then later on realize what we are throwing away, we have a God who pardons. We have a God who's ready to pardon. We have a God who forgives and forgets. And if we have one of those moments where we are wanting the present gratification without thinking about the loss of any future rewards, God will take our prayers, won't he? He will, if we confess our sins, what does John say? God is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So we can get back on track. We have a God that we serve with mercy and pardon. And even if we stumble and we fall, he will forgive us. But, brethren, we know this too. There's always going to be consequences, isn't it? Oh, yeah. And we got to live with that sometimes the rest of our life. David comes to mind in the Old Testament, right? He decided he needed a little instant gratification, right? And he could. The lust was unbridled. He saw that beautiful woman bathing over there, and he could not restrain it. He had to have her. And he knew she had a husband. And he knew what he was doing was adultery. And then he tried to cover it up, didn't he? Well, I'm going to send Uriah into the heat of where I know he's going to die, right? I'm going to put him in the heat of the battle, and odds are he will die, and of course it happened. So in essence, we can say David committed adultery and murder, didn't he? And God forgave him because David is a penitent man, didn't he? Read Psalm 51. That came from the heart, and David knew that God forgave him. And he celebrated that and was happy about that. But did David have to live with the consequences of his actions the rest of his life? Yes. Yes.
It almost seems like David, at that point in his life, felt like he was invincible. But shortly before that, God had supported other people.
Right.
But there would always be somebody, one of his descendants, sitting on the throne.
Right.
And so it almost seems like he was so puffed up and thought, hey,
I can do it.
I can do it anymore. And you're looking at Bathsheba, it looks like she's thinking, hey, I'll trade up. Right? No, it's. She had no respect for her husband.
Obviously.
So obviously she figures, well, she'll trade up to be the lion of Leicester, whatever was in her. But I think that's the problem when it talks about, don't think that, you know, it talks about the scriptures, but that you can withstand everything and you're okay. You know,
yeah.
It says, take heed lest you fall.
So yeah.
Don't ever think you can do without God.
That's a good point. So his sons will rebel against him, won't they? That's the price you pay, David. And you know who David's best friend was? That would be Nathan the prophet, wouldn't he? Because he told him. He made aware to him. You know, God's going to forgive you. That's one thing that made God a man after God's own heart. He had a very good heart. He repented. He asked for forgiveness. And he knew he got it. Read the Psalms and you know he realized he was forgiven. But for the rest of his life, he's going to have to deal with the consequences of his actions on that present moment. It's not going to go away. It's going to be an ever always reminder, isn't it? You know, another Bible character that I consider very noble in this area would be a guy named Moses. And I know some of you know where I'm going. Look in Hebrews 11, verses 24. Let's move away from the book of Genesis for a moment. We all well know that Hebrews 11, as many would call it, is the Old Testament Hall of Fame. And Moses is mentioned, I think, in the context of what we're talking about today. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, you know he spent the first 40 years of his life in Pharaoh's household, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. 25, choosing, and he had a choice, choosing to share ill treatment with the people of God, then what, brethren, enjoy what? The pleasures of sin for a season. You know that instant gratification he could have easily had, couldn't he? Brought up in the royal family? Had it made, his Hebrew brethren were suffering, they were in bondage, and he had a choice. He could keep living the high life,
and enjoying the pleasures of sin for the season, just go ahead and ride that out and enjoy every bit of it. You know, eat, drink today, for tomorrow we'll die. You know, that kind of philosophy that a lot of people have. They don't think of an afterlife and think there are consequences to pay one day. They're going to live it up here and they're going to do it all because they don't really care about what's coming down the line. And he could have been that way, but I love this verse. I love it. He chose rather to share ill treatment with God's people than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He chose the long range rather than the present gratification. And it goes on to say in verse 26, accounting the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. And you know why? And I love this about him too. He looked unto the recompense of what, brethren? He's looking ahead, isn't he? Reward. That's what I'm looking for. Reward. And hey, there's nothing wrong with being motivated by reward. I hope you think about that a lot. Paul, did you know he was motivated by reward? Now, he was also motivated for fear of punishment. No question. You know where that all comes out? Look with me in 2 Corinthians 5, still in the New Testament. And then I'll stop and let some more of you make comments if you choose. 2 Corinthians 5, I'll get over there in a minute as you're getting over there. Really, that his thought really begins in verse chapter 4, actually, verse 17. And you, I know all of you know the Bible was not originally written in books and chapters like we have. And so this was just one flowing letter. So sometimes they start a chapter where they probably shouldn't have, and I think this is one of those occasions, because I think 4, 17, and 18 flow right into 5, 1. But what did he say? Our light affliction, which is for the moment, works for us more and more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, you know, present day, but things which are not seen are eternal. And he said in verse 1, we know that if the earthly house of our tabernacle be dissolved, we have what, brethren? A building from God. A house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. So I think right there we see that Paul was motivated every day by the hope of reward. There's nothing wrong with looking forward to that. Now we got to watch how we live today to be able to get that reward. Was he motivated by fear of punishment? Oh yeah. Look down in chapter 5, and I lost my place. Chapter 5 and about verse 10. We must all be made manifest before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he'd done, whether it be good or bad. So he was motivated by the fear of punishment too, wasn't he? Did you know what else motivated him? Verse 14. Maybe that was his greatest motivation. Was 14. The love of Christ compels me, because we thus judge that one died for all, therefore all died. What else drove Paul? What else motivated Paul? Christ's love, right? The American standard says constrained us, but it really means compel. Anybody have a different word in your translation than constrain or compel? Pretty well it. It drove him. It motivated him every single day. Because he was a beneficiary of Christ's love, wasn't he? And why did Paul often call himself the chief of sinners, right? And I think he had a hard time accepting the fact that God would forgive him, you know, this great persecutor of the church. And yet Christ's love even extended to him. And I think that motivated him every day. I think all of that motivated him.
So I guess my question is this. Are we selling our birthright? Are we selling our birthright? Are we making a bad bargain in a spiritual sense? And it's all how we live our life here. And how might we sell our birthright? I've kind of touched on it. Falling to the passing pleasures of sin that never last. They're only gratifying for the present. And they'll always, you know, and as long as we live with that constant gratification, we are selling our birthright. We are sacrificing our hope of reward. We know the story of Joseph very well too, don't we? In Genesis 37, I'm not going to turn over there. I love to, when I have chances to speak to young people, I love to do lessons on Joseph and Daniel, who we're going to talk about later this morning. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all pretty young men, and they were faithful to God, and they had tough opportunities to turn their back on God. Young people need to know there were young people in the Bible that refused to be overwhelmed by instant gratification. They were looking ahead to that reward. And Joseph was a tremendous example of that. We know the story. Potiphar's wife took a shine to him, didn't she? She really was attracted to him. And she did everything the Bible seemed to indicate she could do to seduce him. And Joseph was a young man. And it would have been real easy because, you know, nobody else is going to know. We know that's not true, but he could have justified that way. We'll have this little affair. I'll experience an instant gratification. Beautiful woman. No one's going to know. Well, that's false. God's going to know, isn't it? And I love his response when he rejected her advances. You know, he literally fled, we know, and rejected her advances. How can I sin against Potiphar? How can I do that? I know that's wrong. I can't do that. That's adultery. But most of all, how can I sin against God, right? God would never, this would not be right then. So he fled the scene. He refused to experience instant gratification because he knew it could jeopardize his future. And the young folks need to know that. They need to know that in so many ways. And there's temptations out there, we know. Give me a warning, please, Tom, when I need to stop, like a 5-minute warning. I know we're getting close to it. You know, we can go with that, right? Young people are especially, we're not exempt, there it is. But our young people really have a struggle, don't they? Because that instant gratification is sitting right out there. Yes, Keith. And that's a good point. Esau did have one good thing about him we know of, because when Jacob was feared, wasn't he? Jacob was afraid. He just knew what was coming when Esau was approaching. He was probably ready to die. And then Esau was wonderful here, wasn't he? He grew up a little, didn't he? And obviously forgave his brother. That is so commendable, and that needs to be brought out. When I'm talking about presidents in my history classes, if I can find anything positive about even a bad one, I will. Sometimes it's got to stretch a bit. I mean, I can find some good things to say about Richard Nixon. I really can. We remember Watergate. But you know what my point is? This is something good about Esau, really. They were estranged, but now they're close again, aren't they? And that's a happy ending. But before our time gets away, and it's getting away, we got to help our young people not make a bad bargain. Because that instant gratification is sitting out there every day, sexually. Experience gratification for the moment and realize what you may be throwing away. And then
sin now, you could potentially be given up a lot. That you might be forgiven, but the consequences will be with you the rest of your life. And to close the lid on Esau, he had to, I commend him for showing love for his brother later. And that's a lot of baggage, right? He could have hated his brother the rest of his life. For what he lost, got to give him that. Thank you. Any other final comments? I could have gone on a little longer, but it's a stop. It was a bad bargain. Let's be careful we don't make one like that too. Okay? Thank you for your comments.